far from being the mundane, everyday and uncomplicated activity we enjoy today without a second thought, historians have in recent times started to realise that reading has a history tied in important ways to processes of political, social and cultural change. The act of reading has changed fundamentally over time. Books meant different things to people living in the past than they do today, competing as they do now with games, consoles, radio, film and television. And since how people read can often be more revealing than what they read, studying the reading habits of people in the past allows us to look differently at how they lived and how they thought. So with this in mind, my lecture today explores the life of reading of Mrs. Elizabeth Rose, a rather unremarkable gentlewoman living in the far north of Scotland in the second half of the 18th century. Since Mrs. Rose never published anything in her own right, she didn't take part in the great upsurge of early British women's writing celebrated here at Chawton House Library. She did, however, reflect on the increasing visibility of women writers in her own lifetime. She read many of the most famous women writers of the age and debated the significance of women's writing with her cousin, the celebrated novelist Henry Mackenzie, who was more than happy to concede that your sex is certainly very high in the Republic of Letters at this very era. Pointing to the publications of female historian Catherine Macaulay, Bluestocking Elizabeth Montagu, and novelist Frances Brooke. Sadly, Elizabeth's side of this correspondence does not survive, but enough of her letters and notebooks do still exist to provide an exceptionally rare insight into the personal significance of reading for women in the 18th century. Now, Elizabeth Rose lived at a particularly important moment in the history of reading. The celebrated Dr. Johnson, who published the first Dictionary of the English Language in 1755, observed with some justification that Britain had become a nation of readers during his lifetime. Literacy rates had improved markedly across society, while more books were produced in cheaper formats than ever before, meaning that books went from being luxury items barely ever encountered beyond the privileged elites to being an essential component of everyday life. A number of innovations pioneered in the book trade extended the reach of print still further, driving down the cost of books and broadening out the reading public to a much larger proportion of the population. So, for instance, the practice of remaindering was invented in the 18th century by James Lackington, whose Temple of the Muses in Finsbury Square, pictured on this slide, became one of the wonders of Georgian London. Essentially, a glorified bookshop around which it was said you could drive a horse and coaches. The Temple of the Muses offered leftover stock at bargain basement prices in the firm belief that books were the key to knowledge, reason and happiness, and that everyone, no matter their economic background, social class or gender, had the right to access books at cheap prices. But you didn't even have to buy books in 18th century Britain to read them, for this was as much a great age of book borrowing as it was of book production. Benevolent landowners happily lent books to their friends, neighbours, relatives and those less fortunate in the wider community, with country house libraries evolving into sociable drawing rooms, complete with welcoming hearths to read by and comfortable sofas to relax in. That is why 18th century landowners were so often painted in their libraries, surrounded by their acculturating books, although few are as homely as this endearing portrait of the family of George Cholmondeley, painted by Hogarth in the comfortable family library, with the Viscount evidently caught in the act of reading to his wife, while the boys play boisterously around a precarious pile of books on the right-hand side of the portrait. A voluntary movement emerged that emulated this newfound love for the printed word that flourished in private households. With like-minded individuals in towns and villages across the country, clubbing together to fund the acquisition of books collectively, which many of them could not afford separately. Thus, the 18th century witnessed for the first time the rapid distribution of public libraries and book clubs, funded and maintained by members who paid a subscription for the privilege and housed in elaborate neoclassical temples to knowledge and learning, like the Liverpool Lyceum, which is on the bottom right here, built in 1802 to house the town's first library, but now sadly abandoned and largely derelict, with one of the town's main train stations in its basement. For James Lackington, as much as for Samuel Johnson, this unprecedented upsurge in the availability of books helped engineer a dramatic shift in the importance of reading in 18th century Britain. He says, the poorer sort of people who before that period spent their winter evenings in relating stories of witches, ghosts and hobgoblins now shortened the winter nights by hearing their sons and daughters read tales and romances. On entering their houses, you may see Tom Jones, Roderick Random and other entertaining novels stuck up on their bacon racks. And if John goes to town with a load of hay, he is charged to be sure not to forget to bring home Peregrine Pickle's Adventures. And when Dolly is sent to market to sell her eggs, she is commissioned to purchase the History of Joseph Andrews. In short, he says, all ranks and degrees now read. Lackington implies that the quantitative transformation of the world of books brought with us a seismic shift in the qualitative experience of reading, reflecting his profound faith in the potential of books to bring about progressive enlightenment and the retreat from superstitious stories of witches, ghosts and hobgoblins that had blighted the unreading past. The practice of reading underpinned the 18th century Enlightenment, a cultural movement across Europe that sought to harness the power of reason to advance knowledge, reform society and improve the lives of ordinary people, suppressed for so long by feudalism and ignorance. Since books were the basic building blocks of Enlightenment, reading was the process through which personal enlightenment and improvement could be achieved, just as they figuratively construct the woman in this contemporary cartoon on the right-hand side of the slide. But these developments didn't come without risk. By releasing so many new readers into the reading nation, 18th century writers constantly worried about the moral implications for society, contrasting the ideal self-improving reader pictured here against the figure of the self-indulgent reader. Wading indiscriminately through the vast quantity of vacuous and immoral books flooding the market. As this extract from an extremely popular conduct book reveals, and we'll mention this book a lot more later on, contemporary critics were particularly concerned by the influence of novels on the female reading public. We consider the general run of novels utterly unfit for you. Instruction they convey none. They paint scenes of pleasure and passion altogether improper for you to behold, even with the mind's eye. Their descriptions are often loose and luscious in a high degree. Their representations of love between the sexes are almost universally overstrained. The majority of their loves are either mere lunatics or mock heroes. And the accompanying illustration sums up the danger, the doting mother horrified to discover a pernicious novel hidden under her daughter's pillow. By the time of Dr. Johnson's death, then, in 1784, the stereotypical female novel reader had thereby become the epitome of the misguided, self-indulgent reading public. Books filled her with delusive ideas, swayed by false notions of love and romance, leading at the very least to frivolity and impulsiveness, and possibly even to sexual indiscretion. This morally degenerate female novel reader was, of course, largely a fictional caricature. And in my lecture today, I'll be attempting to separate fact from fiction, asking what reading meant to one historical woman reader, whose reading habits and strategies by no means matched up to this contemporary stereotype. I wanted to consider how books helped shape Elizabeth Rose's life and the lives of her family, friends and neighbours, what books meant to her, how she used reading to navigate her social responsibilities and relationships, and ultimately how writing about her reading became a vitally important means by which this woman negotiated her own role in society. First, though, I need to say a few more words about who she was, because the changing circumstances of her life ultimately dictated how and why she read. So Elizabeth Rose was born in 1747 to one of the oldest landed families in northeastern Scotland. The Rose Lairds of Kilrock near Nairn had led an unexceptional existence as farmers and minor landowners since perhaps as far back as the 13th century, tending always to shy away from politics, controversies and the affairs of great men. As such, Elizabeth, by her own admission, grew up in relatively privileged and quiet conditions. In her own endearing imagery, she said she was fostered like a hotbed plant in the lap of ease and indulgence. In this sense, Elizabeth would have attracted little historical attention in her own right if the minutes of her remarkable life of reading hadn't come down to us, and had she not maintained a studied correspondence with one of the leading literary celebrities of the day, her cousin Henry Mackenzie, who we've already met. But she was exceptional in one other sense. From 1772, the Rose family experienced a series of losses that transformed Elizabeth's carefree life of privilege forever. In November 1772, she lost first her elder brother and then her father, who she calls the best of parents, both deeply distressing events in their own right, however sadly routine. Still worse was to follow when Elizabeth's husband died during her pregnancy, scarcely 6 months after their marriage, at the relatively late age, for the period at least, of 32, leaving her to bring up their son alone. And to top it all, when her surviving brother then died childless less than a year later, Elizabeth was left as the sole remaining heir to the land and title of Kilrock. As she wrote in her diary in 1784, "What an astonishing chain of providences in private life has the course of the last 3 years brought about to lead me back to the seat of my ancestors. A wife, a widow, a mother, in this space during which the death of an only brother, childless, devolves upon me the representation of my family, and rests its future hope upon one feeble reed." Elizabeth's life had thereby changed forever, and these changes proved crucial for Elizabeth's subsequent life of reading, as I hope to explain. She became the central figure in the tiny provincial county of Nairnshire, and the moving spirit in its social and cultural calendar. She even took on the family's traditional role in helping to nominate the county's Member of Parliament, although she usually delegated these formal political duties to her cousin Mackenzie, in deference to contemporary conventions regarding women's participation in the political arena. Veteran soldiers returning from active service paid their respects, while what young men leaving the county called on her to receive advice, assistance, and the crucial letters of introduction that would get them by. No stranger of note visited the area without being entertained by her, not least the celebrated Scots poet Rabbi Burns, who wrote glowingly of his reception at Kilrock, of its wild scenery, the venerable grandeur of the castle, the spreading woods, the winding river, but also of the romantic figure of Elizabeth herself, your late distressful anxieties, your present enjoyments, your dear little angel, the pride of your hopes. So her social supremacy was such that locals knew Elizabeth Rose as the Queen of Nairn, but as Burns reminds us, Elizabeth's first duty was to protect and preserve the family's fortune. She worked hard to improve the estates, paid off many of the debts that had been accumulated by her dissolute brothers, and superintended the upbringing of her only son. Her childhood had not in the least prepared her for such responsibility, providing, in her own words, with only the surface of an education, fitted to adapt one to please in prosperous days, but not to form one to be useful in adverse ones. Her reading, therefore, came to focus explicitly on the crucial problem of protecting her family's fortune, future prospects, which she interprets to mean the proper moral education of her son. And this is encapsulated in a poem she writes at the end of 1788, when he is about seven. "Now welcome moral bliss and joy, science and books my hours employ, and fill my mind with truth, to soothe the dying parent's age, an infant son to truth engage, his sinking fortunes to prop. These are my earthly foils. If blessed by providence, secure I'll rest till to the grave I drop." Thus, the pursuit of moral truth through reading was to become the focal point of Elizabeth's adult life, after personal tragedy had thrust her so suddenly into the world of men to such an extent that was at once unconventional in the era in which she lived and entirely unexpected in the course of her own life. Thankfully, Elizabeth Rose had ample materials on which to found her re-education. So upon inheriting Kilrock, she decided to create a lasting record of the family library, which amounted to nearly 2,000 titles. In common with most country house libraries of the time, it was particularly strong in classical and foreign language literature, particularly French, but it also held many of the most innovative texts of the age, including leading books of the Enlightenment, as well as many books written explicitly for the moral education of young ladies, including the Sermons for Young Women I quoted from earlier by James Fordyce. In addition to the books she had readily available at home, Elizabeth was also able to borrow books regularly from friends, relatives, and neighbours. That much is evident from her voluminous journals, which record her reading many books that she didn't actually own and admiring books belonging to others. So on one fleeting visit to attend a ball at nearby Gordon Castle, she admires the many books that I wished for leisure to examine in the Duchess's apartment. She may also have borrowed books from any of the lending libraries that were springing up in local villages, the Forest Subscription Library, for instance, or Isaac Forsyth's Elgin Circulating Library, which are close friends, the Brodies of Leithen House, who I'll say more about in a moment, frequented in the 1790s. As might be expected in a family so thoroughly immersed in the world of books, a love of reading was instilled in Elizabeth from a very early age. She remembered with fondness the many winter evenings when I was scarcely 9 years old that I have sat by my father reading translations of the classics, his silence for hours only broken to bless me with fervour or to utter some fond appellation. Other male relatives helped foster her interest in literature, repeating the advice of well-known published authorities that we know she read. So her uncle, Dr. John Clephane, wrote to her that reading and writing deserve great application when she was barely 10, while Henry Mackenzie advised her to have more confidence in her own opinions on literature. So you need make no apology to me for grave remarks, nor be so modestly afraid of going beyond your depth. Your grave remarks are equally natural, benevolent, and pious. And we also know that she asked these people for advice about how to read. Mackenzie was more than happy to oblige when Elizabeth asked his advice on the crucial question of how to read. So he says, "I am very little able to point out anything like a proper system of reading. To you, I fancy, it is very little necessary. But there is one method which, in my opinion, is not a little useful in reading any book of excellence, especially if it is a book of original observation. And that is, when we find any remark particularly impressive, to take it down in writing, subjoining with any comments that our own view of it may suggest. These, when we meet with passages tending to illustrate them in the same or other authors, we may review, correct, and alter. This, I believe, will be found to give a freedom of thinking on all subjects and a distinctness on that one upon which we are employed." It's unclear whether or not Elizabeth immediately took up this advice, as we do not know when she started to compile extracts from her reading in precisely this manner. What we can be sure of is that she kept notebooks containing passages of this kind for many years, enough of which survived to allow us to reconstruct something of her intentions and responses to reading. In the first place, and on the face of it, Elizabeth was a surprisingly compliant reader. Her extracts were just that, passages of text she had extracted or transcribed from the books she read, rarely adding her own comments or reflections, and without putting her notes in her own words, as we would insist on today. Yet this doesn't mean that the extracts reveal little about what Elizabeth thought of the books she read or how she used them. And in fact, the key to understanding her priorities lies in the process of selection going on in the passages that she takes out. So from books that particularly caught her attention, Elizabeth extracted many such passages. So from Fanny Burney's novel Cecilia, Elizabeth Rose took more than a dozen passages, each removed out of their context to provide some kind of moral lesson that Elizabeth could apply to her own life and circumstances. And this includes this passage, which seemed to justify Elizabeth's lifelong bookishness. As Cecilia's next solicitude was to furnish herself with a well-chosen collection of books, and this employment proved a source of entertainment so fertile and delightful that it left her nothing to wish. Thus, in the exercise of charity, the search of knowledge, and the enjoyment of quiet, serenely in innocent philosophy passed the hours of Cecilia. And you can picture Elizabeth seeing herself in the words here. At other times, Elizabeth could be far more ruthless. So from the whole of The New Clarissa, she extracted just two lines on the theme of modesty and young women, quote, who are destined to be mothers, while the same was true of Elizabeth Pinchard's novel The Blind Child. With the touching passage in which young Helen Wyndham's blindness came to be cured, taken down by Elizabeth Rose, as a moral sermon on the meaning of sensibility rather than exaggerated and affected emotionalism. So in the course of my practice as the surgeon, eagerly transcribed by Elizabeth, I witness so much affectation, so much exaggerated feeling. I see people unable to attend their relatives when it's absolutely necessary, running away from scenes of pain and inconvenience with so much selfishness as quite sickens me sometimes of sensibility. But you, my dear Miss Wyndham, have reconciled me to it, since I perceive you make it assistant to, not destructive of, your duties. This, he says, is true sensibility. So in this manner, Elizabeth habitually appropriated books for herself, dislocating text from its original context to serve her own purposes. Her note-taking was highly selective, with her notebooks together constituting a homemade encyclopedia of what she considered the most significant passages drawn from her favourite authors. Some books provided her with pages of material, like Cecilia, and others with just a few lines, particularly this one from Pinchard. And there were many books from which she doesn't actually seem to have taken anything down at all. Rather than wallowing in romantic novels, as the contemporary caricature would suggest, these reading practices demonstrate that Elizabeth's reading took reading very seriously. Her extracts took the form of extended moral parables, easily accessible to the circumstances of her own life, and fully reflecting the belief in the morally improving power of reading she expressed in the poem I mentioned at the start. Since these notebooks survive from different periods in her life, we can also trace how her reading priorities changed over time, neatly illustrating how far Elizabeth's appropriation of books was contingent on her own circumstances, changing as those circumstances themselves changed. So an early notebook devoted entirely to Hume's History of England, for instance, compiled while she was a teenager, acted clearly as a testing ground for Elizabeth's highly self-conscious approach, a pedagogical exercise in which she learned to read critically and selectively in the manner I've described, with her note-taking getting progressively more sophisticated, more accurate, and more perceptive as she progressed chronologically through the book. By the time she had finished, she was well able to manipulate the intended meanings of Hume's narrative, in particular censoring Hume's notoriously pejorative treatment of religious figures and themes. So where Hume had criticised Edward VI's narrow prepossession, bigotry and persecution, Elizabeth devoutly noted instead that Edward had been staunch to the principles of the Reformation. And where Hume talked cold-bloodedly about how many Protestants had been brought to the stake by Mary Tudor, and he uses the phrase "computed," Elizabeth substitutes the more reverential phrase "committed to the flames." Abridging Hume's history in this way was actually a really common project for elite teenagers in the period, designed to give both boys and girls a comprehensive familiarity with the means by which Britain had risen to the position of global wealth and power she enjoyed by this time. In a culture obsessed with knowledge and pride in the past, Hume's history gave teenagers like Elizabeth something respectable to talk about in the country circuit of assemblies, balls, and grand dinner parties. Above all, it was a task designed to instill in them vital notions of national identity from an early age, subconsciously preparing them to lead the next generation of patriotic mothers, sisters, and housewives, as well as the next generation of imperial governors, politicians, and soldiers. For these reasons, presumably, Elizabeth's father or her tutor had set her to the task of abridging Hume, but we can immediately see how the project serves as a training programme in her preferred style of reading. And we can already see the abiding principles of her reading coming to the fore, notably the devotional, deeply Christian sense for moral truth, and the search for moral truth in what she read. In notebooks compiled in the mid-1780s and 1790s, a very different type of reading emerges, focusing instead on key questions at stake in the moral education of her son. Now widowed and a single mother, Elizabeth devoted an entire notebook to the crucial moral question of whether a domestic or public education was appropriate for her son. Accordingly, her sole extract from Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, a hugely influential work of moral philosophy, focused explicitly on the problem at hand. Domestic education is the institution of nature, public education the contrivance of man. It is surely unnecessary to say which is likely to be the wisest. Even Dr. Johnson, of dictionary fame, contributed to this directory of learned opinions on the crucial question of educating his son. And those of you who know some of my background will understand why I always use this passage. This is the passage where Johnson ruminates on the moral suitability of St. Andrew's University as a seat of learning, exposing, he says, the minds and manners of young men neither to the levity and dissoluteness of a capital city nor to the gross luxury of a town of commerce, places naturally unpropitious to learning. In one, the desire of knowledge easily gives way to the love of pleasure, and in the other, in danger of yielding to the love of money. Notably, this was the only passage Elizabeth appears to have noted down from Johnson's popular account of his journey to the Western Isles, and its impact on her decision-making is reflected tangibly in the fact that her son later attended St. Andrew's University, with his mother in attendance just to make sure wee Hugh kept to the straight and narrow. As she grew older and the need to take such an active interest in her son's moral education decreased, Elizabeth came to ruminate increasingly on the theme of moral truth itself, reflecting her deep commitment to the Presbyterian Kirk. Throughout her life, Elizabeth dedicated early mornings to devotional readings of passages from Scripture and other Orthodox texts, but her faith also impinged on her reading of philosophy. As she matured and became more confident in her own opinions, she increasingly used conservative philosophers like James Beattie and Thomas Reid to resist the more controversial, sceptical philosophy of the Radical Enlightenment, which by the 1790s was widely seen by contemporaries as a root cause of the bloody excesses of the French Revolution. So most dramatically, she transcribed at length the sequence of Beattie's most combustible attacks on Hume's attempts to undermine Christian belief in the afterlife, and thereby to violate this last refuge of the miserable and rob them of the only comfort that had survived the ravages of misfortune, malice, and tyranny. And it's notable that she takes down passages like this on Hume without apparently consulting Hume's original at any stage, even though Hume's collected essays in which his sceptical views appeared sat alongside Beattie's essay on truth in the Kilrock Castle Library. So she's got access to both of them, but she only listens to this bit. In the late 1790s, we see another type of extract creeping into Elizabeth's reading notes, this time emitting a sense of the regretful melancholy of old age. So in this typical passage taken down by Elizabeth Rose, the romantic poet Ossian recalls, "My friends are gone, their memory, like the stones of their tomb, is half sunk, and the place of their abode is desolate. But such changes are not the lot of the bard alone." By meditating on such passages, Elizabeth was not associating herself with a stereotypical sentimental female reader, blinded by unbridled passion and grief, who was so often condemned by contemporary critics. Instead, Elizabeth hoped to come better to terms with her own losses that I described earlier by meditating on such passages to minimise what she called elsewhere their depredations on domestic delight, so that her deeply felt grief wouldn't compromise her virtuous emotions and plunge her into an orgy of uncontrolled self-pity. Such passages could also have a more practical value, helping her cultivate the sympathetic fellow feeling required to console and uplift her closest friends at their time of grief. Hence her earnest pledge to the Russell Sisters of Earl's Mill, who again I'll mention in a moment, on the death of their father, quote, "to soften for a moment the weight of their affliction." Though this consoling reading remains important for the rest of Elizabeth's life, and we can track this through the reading notebooks dating to that period in her life, another preoccupation emerges to lift the apparent gloom. With her son married off and dispatched to a lucrative career in Edinburgh, Elizabeth turned her attention to the moral education of his daughters, her granddaughters. The last notebook, begun when Elizabeth was 59, contains a plethora of passages from novels by female authors explicitly aimed at the moral education of young ladies, including those by Fanny Burney and Elizabeth Pinchard I mentioned earlier. with its focus largely on female exemplar, hardly appropriate for a widely read widow in her 60s, this last notebook was probably compiled with the moral guidance of her granddaughters in mind, intended to inculcate in them the conservative moral virtues that Elizabeth herself favoured. In fact, in a touching codicil to her will that I discovered since I gave the paper that you mentioned at the start, Elizabeth bequeathed her books and personal papers, including the reading notebooks, presumably, to her eldest granddaughter, Isabella. So we can think quite literally of this last notebook as a form of literary composition, intended to be passed down to her granddaughters as a compilation of safely virtuous readings, pre-censored by their devoted grandmother for their edification and proper moral development. Hence the direct appeal to the reader in this extract Elizabeth took from Rachel Hunter's Gothic novel Letitia and positioned strategically at the very start of the final notebook to show her granddaughters precisely how such moral stories of young women should be read. She says, "You should see in this excellent woman what the Christian school can effect. You will see her going on in the uprightness of her mind, undeviating duty, dispensing blessings to all around her, living in peace and charity with all, and cheerfully contented with obedience, believing that her future happiness will not be measured by her wisdom, but by her good works. Observe her heedfully. You will be taught to appreciate genuine piety and goodness at its full worth. For she will convince you that these are the foundations of the building, and without these, the most elaborate ornaments are rubbish." And this obviously sounds like Elizabeth speaking directly to the granddaughters, but actually it's another one of these passages that she's taken down from a contemporary novel. Though the moral well-being of her own family was evidently uppermost in Elizabeth's life of reading at its various stages, whether it be her son or her granddaughters or herself indeed, her notebooks always had a wider social role. She often lent her books to people, sometimes going so far as to copy them as gifts for particularly close friends and neighbours. Elizabeth's reading notes thereby reached far beyond the privacy of her own study, circulating widely across the Highlands of Scotland. And I'm coming across more and more evidence that it did so. So the self-taught Victorian stonemason, Hugh Miller, wrote glowingly in his autobiography of childhood encounters with Elizabeth's notebooks, portions of which, he says, "I had an opportunity of perusing when on my visit to my friend Miss Dunbar, and there is a copy of one of them still now in my possession. At a time when formal schooling was decidedly patchy for working class boys like Hugh Miller and for girls of all social ranks, Elizabeth's notebooks took on the role of informal schoolmaster for Miller and for Miss Dunbar in their attempts to educate themselves through reading." And for those of you at the back who might not be able to see, Miller's biography is called My Schools and Schoolmasters. So he really is talking about Elizabeth in the autobiography really as if she's a teacher. Since Miller came across the reading journals of Mrs. Rose through Helen Dunbar, one of her closest friends of a younger generation, Miller probably never met Mrs. Rose in person. There's certainly nothing in the autobiography suggests he did. But we can be sure that reading was central to Elizabeth's relationships with those she did know well. Her daily diaries abound with references to sociable reading, and on these occasions, Elizabeth shared her reading strategies with female relatives, neighbours and friends, whether reading aloud late into the evening with her stepdaughters by an open fire, or strolling through the garden discussing books and music with her cousin Jeannie and the ladies of Leithen, or spending the evening in literary conversation with the Miss Brodies. And it's this pair that I want to pick up on now. Henry Mackenzie had in fact already set reading at the heart of Elizabeth's relationship with the Brodie sisters of Leithen when he wrote to introduce them to the area. "You will before this time," he says, "have acquired a set of neighbours in Mrs. Brodie and her daughters at Leithen. They need hardly go thither to find solitude, as they live uncommonly recluse in town. I fancy there is a natural shyness that runs through the family, yet I am told the eldest girl is far from wanting parts and has considerably improved them by reading." And from this moment onwards, from their arrival in the area, we see the natural shyness that Mackenzie considered a defining characteristic of the sisters being steadily broken down by their love of books. It was through shared reading, Elizabeth's diary makes clear, that these two young women became integrated and accepted in Elizabeth's social network. And there's even the strong suggestion in this surviving portrait on the right-hand side of the elder of the two Brodie sisters, Anne, that they sought to emulate Elizabeth's critical reading practices, portrayed as she is here not with a printed book open in front of her, as is so often the case in late 18th century female portraiture, but with her hand instead holding a blank manuscript open on a desk, with a quill pen stationed suggestively to the very far side of the portrait. With the Russell Sisters of Earl's Mill, another family I mentioned earlier, Elizabeth struck up a particularly close bond. The eldest sister, Margaret, had been her dearest childhood friend, so much so that upon Margaret's untimely death, Elizabeth eventually was persuaded to marry her widower to help look after Margaret's motherless daughters, the stepdaughters with whom she spent so many of the evenings reading aloud by the fireside. But Elizabeth also took Margaret's younger sisters under her wing, developing a lifelong bond built very much on shared literary tastes and mutual self-education. The women constantly sent reflections on the books they had read to each other, sometimes sending these letters more than once a day, with Elizabeth chiding or praising her friends for their precocious opinions. Here, she takes to task the younger sister, Betty, who was still a child at this point, for criticising the works of one of Elizabeth's favourite moral philosophers. "I am vexed to see, my dear Betty, that you have conceived so bad an opinion of Lord Kames. I never heard one speak more to my mind on any of the most important truths, and I think the book I am at present reading cannot fail to please the nicest taste." And even in their more advanced years, Elizabeth and Euphemia, the middle sister, continued to recommend books to each other, clinging, as Elizabeth does in the quotation at the bottom of the slide, to the flattering idea that ours are kindred minds. Intriguingly, the three women often compared notes on the sermons written explicitly for the education of women that I mentioned right at the start by James Fordyce. "I have got an excellent discourse by Fordyce on the advantages to be derived to young men from the society of our sex," Elizabeth writes eagerly, and she later hassles the Russell sisters for their opinion on that same discourse. "When you write, give me your opinion of Fordyce's discourse." She later sent along the copy itself, having dotted with my pencil the passages I liked and expressing her hope that the passages would please the girl's mother. Elizabeth clearly admired these educational texts greatly. "He is a friend of our sex, and therefore I like him," she says. Although, as many of you may know, other women were less enamoured, sending him up for his pedantry, which again is mentioned here by Elizabeth, rather than taking his message seriously, which I think is clear Elizabeth does. Thus, these very same sermons to young women appear in Pride and Prejudice as one of the favourite books of the absurd Reverend Collins, aptly reflecting his boorish and chauvinistic attitudes to women. As Elizabeth comments on Fordyce reveal, her letters to the Russell sisters were often accompanied by the physical books themselves, sometimes annotated, as she does here, with manuscript notes, ticks in the margin, or notes on the blank pages at the front and end, which seem to have served very similar purposes to her notebooks, sort of picking out those passages that she most thought most important, or actually superintending text onto the blank pages to help explain the book that was being read. So in this example, Elizabeth enters into her own copy an extract from a review of Elizabeth Hamilton's novel The Cottages of Glenburnie, telling its reader that Mrs. Hamilton has undertaken the most difficult and unthankful of all tasks, that of telling her friends their faults. The point being of the review that she's writing about here, that Highlanders were too introverted, too resistant to strangers and to change. Dislocated from their original context and entered instead on the blank pages either side of the title page, such passages helped shape the reader's responses to The Cottages of Glenburnie, adapted clearly to the circumstances in which this particular copy, the Kilrock Castle copy, would be read. The educational potential of such marginalia in the reading relationship between Elizabeth and the Russell sisters is reflected throughout their correspondence, and I'm actually still just trying to work my way through it. but perhaps most tellingly is reflected in a brief but revealing note which accompanied Elizabeth's copy of Rousseau's Emile to Earl's Mill. And this book is one of the most influential educational manuals of the Enlightenment, but one that was so controversial it was publicly burned by the Paris executioner in 1762. Encountering the book in the sleepy highlands of Scotland a little over 10 years later, Elizabeth acknowledges the book's well-known shortcomings, advising at the start firmly that this was a book that ought not to migrate beyond the little back room. Intriguingly, such are the book's oddities that she says she would ideally transcribe a distilled version for their edification, and bemoans the fact that she doesn't have time to sift it for your sakes into one of her reading notebooks. Despite these reservations, Elizabeth feels obliged to send Emile to Earl's Mill for its pedagogical message, happy in the knowledge that she had sufficiently prepared the girls for the pitfalls awaiting them in this most controversial of books. What relates to Sophia's education is so much adapted for your improvement and so suited to your taste, she writes, that I can't resist sending you the book. In several parts of his description of Sophia, I thought on you, the neatness of her person, her extreme temperance, her sumptuous cleanliness, and so on. All these things put me in mind of the Earl's Mill tatties, whom I must now leave. Mama is stirring and breakfast near ready. So, fittingly, given the emphasis of most contemporary complaints about the moral propriety of women's reading, it's her domestic duties that seem to prevent Elizabeth transcribing sanitised passages from the book for the girls. Rather than hiding away in her bedroom closet, seduced into laziness and immorality by it, Elizabeth opts for her domestic duties, namely preparing breakfast for her mother. But Elizabeth's later discussion of another of Rousseau's influential novels seems to reiterate similar themes. Most importantly, the notion that Rousseau would pay the pains better than most other books. Here, as she sits up late one evening, unable to sleep, she presents a striking image of her self-conceived role in the Russell sisters' education. Indeed, would I teach my lovely pupil all I know? All this hour, at this hour, this day, tonight, perhaps she'll be receiving a lesson from her own Elizabeth Rose. And the lesson here could be variously interpreted as being the advice Elizabeth provides on reading these books, the model her notebooks provide for a properly regulated method of reading, or perhaps even the material books themselves, carefully selected, critically annotated, and lovingly packaged from Kilbock to Earl's Mill for the sisters' edification. I began this lecture, of course, with a quite different vision of women's reading in Georgian Britain. The rapid expansion of the reading nation during the 18th century was thought to pose a very serious threat to the moral stability of the nation, putting in the hands of impressionable young ladies a whole host of devious novels designed to undermine their virtue and break their character. As is so often the case with such caricatures, the fictional stereotype was rarely acted out in practice. And it's just as common to come across reading notes that heed the advice of conducted writers like James Fordyce, striving to read literature in the approved manner. Elizabeth's social position was obviously extraordinarily privileged. She lived as the lady of the manor, free to buy as many books as her pocket would allow, with the social prestige to have her views listened to and respected, whether or not they made sense. But in many ways, Elizabeth's reading habits can stand in for the reading experience of many more ordinary women in the 18th century, shedding remarkable light on what reading meant to people living in this age without radio, television, and film. Although Elizabeth's circle were aware of the literary achievements of celebrated women, writers like Catherine Macaulay and Frances Brooke, none of them seem ever to have considered entering the literary marketplace in their own right. They display none of the urge to engage in independent scholarship and learning for its own sake that characterised the famous Blue Stockings led by Elizabeth Montagu. Nor is there any sense that these women readers sympathise with the more radical conceptions of women's education, intellectual ability and political rights that were emerging with Mary Wollstonecraft in the 1790s. And in fact, Wollstonecraft's vindication of the rights of women seems to have passed the conservative Highlands of Scotland entirely by. It's certainly nowhere in here or any other reading notebooks I've looked at. Instead, Elizabeth's reading and the reading of the community who gravitated around her idealised the domesticity of reading, believing firmly in its morally improving power and in the fundamental value of refined taste, sound judgment, and mental cultivation. Reading seems to have been a vital means to self-education for such women. Reading together allowed them to understand the world around them. It taught them how to behave. It encouraged them to socialise, if we remember the shy Brodie sisters. And above all, it prepared them to be dutiful wives, virtuous mothers, and effective educators. Indeed, Elizabeth's life of reading reveals the central role reading played in the history of British education before the development of formal schooling. Domestic education, which I've mentioned earlier, was founded on the practice of reading in the household, with mothers telling their children not only what to read, but also how to read. And these informal educational practices, encouraged by the close bonds of friendship and sociability that tied rural Georgian society together, readily extended to friends and neighbours, so that 18th century women readers really did act as schools and schoolmasters for each other, as well as for their children and dependents. And as my final quotation reveals, the Russell sisters of Earl's Mill understood fully how much their family owed to their reading relationship with Elizabeth Rose, and sought to expose their own children to her virtuous reading practices. Here, Euphemia Russell approaches her dearest friend with a heartfelt plea on behalf of her own son, Cosmo Innes, who at this time was a seven-year-old boy who would later marry Elizabeth's granddaughter Isabella and mature into one of the foremost historians of 19th century Scotland. And she writes, "I think the boy will hardly be a Latin scholar, but he is fond of reading and rather well informed for his years. Might I venture to solicit for him some small portion of your favour? And if you found him worthy to bestow upon him as little of that winning way with which you introduced knowledge into young and greedy minds, I should consider it like bequeathing a valuable inheritance to a child who has none but the kindness of a very few friends and his own exertions." For these women, then, reading was far from mundane. They believed fervently in the transformational power of reading, investing their family's future fortunes in books, both in material terms, but also clearly in moral terms. Books were not passive objects, but a vital means through which women could actively interact with the world beyond their own homes, allowing them, encouraging them even, to become intellectual and cultural agents of change in their own right.